leadership meeting that went over this morning. Boy, those 7:30 meetings are killers, especially when you stay here late at night. Welcome to the Capitol. It is Oregon State University Day. I will have a, Senator Morissette has a banner for us. I will have an orange scarf here. I won't be wearing it as a duck. I just can't do that. But we will, thank you. We will have a scarf here in honor of OSU Day. We're very proud of all the universities in Oregon, but as an alumni of the University of Oregon, my allegiance first is to the University of Oregon Ducks, who did a great job this year in basketball, but the Beavers do great work in other areas as well, and we're proud to have all these Beaver fans in the Capitol today. So with that, please, my rule in this committee is to turn off all your cell phones and PDAs. That's really critical, because if I hear it go off, we're going to make you give money to the Common School Fund to help fund education in Oregon. If you came to sign up sheet's over there. And I think first up, we've got Senate Bill 365, so I'll open a public hearing on that, and Ms. Richardson will tell us what's going on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 365 directs publishers of college textbooks to provide prospective purchasers a complete list of the publisher's products, the wholesale price of each product, and the estimated length of time the publisher intends to keep the product on the market. Requires any person selling textbook bundles to public higher education institutions to offer the option of purchasing the bundle components separately. Requires any person selling textbook bundles to disclose information in all of their communications with end users about purchasing an individual textbook, the availability and cost of the textbook. This would apply to textbooks purchased on or after the effective date of the act. The committee also has in front of them a -1 amendment. Shall I briefly go over that? The -1 amendment replaces substantive provisions of the measure. It removes the definition of products, and it adds private institutions of higher education. It requires publishers, as opposed to persons, selling textbook bundles to public higher education institutions to offer the option of purchasing the bundle components separately. It requires the publisher, again, as opposed to the person that's mentioned in the bill, that sells textbook bundles to disclose information in all communications with end user, the information on the availability and cost of the textbooks purchased separately. And for your reference, there's also an opinion from LC on the constitutionality of the bill.
Okay, and we have Ms. Hunt here who will be available to talk about that. Senator Morissette, this is your bill. You want to come forward and bring whoever you wish? And I don't know, do you want Ms. Hunt to be with you also to discuss the constitutionality, or we'll have her come up a little bit later. Ms. Hunt, just for your record, I mean, just for your timing, I'll take you after these folks so you can go back and do all those great and wonderful amendments we're always asking you to do. Thank you. Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, and I inadvertently wore a green shirt this morning.
Would you like this scarf temporarily?
No, I have this in case Frank Morris was here, but he's not here, so I can take it. I do, as you support OSU. I am a Duck fan, but I think OSU is an institution we can be proud of in many, many ways.
Absolutely.
And one of the ways is by dealing with the bill, the issue at hand this morning. I guess we could call it the to bundle or not to bundle bill. This bill has been around for a couple of sessions. Hasn't gone anywhere before. But I think it's time. It's a cost containment issue that is very important, because we are working very hard on issues at the university and supporting the university and supporting the students and trying to keep tuition down and concerned about student loan costs and all of those things. And the textbook bundling or the issue of textbooks is of prime importance, and I think we must address that. You have some expert testimony that is being presented, so I will end my comments there. I think it's a great effort, a great bill, and I think it's time, and so I certainly hope that you support it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Walker and members of the committee. My name is Laura Atherton. I'm the consumer advocate with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. And there are a number of students and faculty here today who have day-to-day experience with textbooks, their prices, and how the industry has changed over the years, and the increasing challenges to affording textbooks as part of a college education. So I'll keep my comments very brief. This bill addresses a number of the key drivers of the increasing cost of college textbooks. And this is, college textbooks cost a lot more than they did back when a lot of us were in college. According to a 2005 report by the U.S. Government General Accountability Office, textbooks and supplies are a significant college cost, and prices are rising faster than inflation. A number of factors are contributing to this, including frequent new editions of textbooks, which are sometimes justified and sometimes not, but that's one of the key drivers. Also, the practice of bundling textbooks, which is to basically shrink wrap textbooks together with other educational materials, CD-ROMs, workbooks, which are sometimes useful but not always, and it's not always available without being bundled. And so that adds anywhere from 10 to 50% to the cost of the textbook, sometimes for unnecessary materials. And finally, there are some disclosure problems, just transparency. One of the key pieces of any functional market is if the purchaser knows the price of the item they're purchasing. And oftentimes faculty have a difficult time finding out the products and the prices and the estimated length of time that that textbook will be on the market before a new edition. And so those are key components that will help to give faculty and students some tools to help reduce the price of textbooks wherever possible. Thank you very much, and I'm available for questions.
Okay.
As well.
Ms. Atherton, you gave me a memo yesterday. Are you going to share that with the committee? Or?
Madam Chair, I shared that with in advance of this hearing with all the members of the committee.
Okay. I was reviewing mine somewhere yesterday and left it upstairs in my office somewhere, and I'd asked my staff to bring it down, but I don't know if they'd be able to find it. And I'd written some notes because you cited some examples in there that were pretty appalling. Do you have a copy of that I could look at? Here. Does somebody have that memo she passed around yesterday? Ah, there it is.
Yep.
I won't have all my highlights. Thank you, Senator. But there were a couple of questions that I had for you. Darn, I wish I had my own copy. There were examples that you gave where they would bundle textbooks in a way, and they would add the workbooks, and the workbooks might not be used by the instructor, but because the workbooks were in there, they were forced to buy all that stuff anyway, and then they couldn't resell it on the used book market. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. About half of the books in a recent survey that we did were in bundled packages, and more than half of the ones that were bundled were actually not available in an unbundled format. And sometimes those additional materials are useful and faculty decide to use them as part of their curriculum, but not always. About two-thirds of faculty say that they use those bundled additional sort of add-on materials rarely or never. Mm-hmm. And so this bill simply gives faculty the option of ordering a book without the additional materials
a la carte
that they won't use. Exactly, a la carte.
A la carte without all the junk. And then there was also, you talked about sometimes the low-cost versions actually were not so low-cost when you totaled it up. Okay, well, there was something else in here, and I'll look and see if it'll come to my memory. But
great.
Any questions from the committee? You know, I still have all my expenses when I went to the University of Oregon from 74 to 78. I'm going to clean my attic out and actually throw that stuff out this summer because it's kind of ridiculous. That was many years ago, but I had kept a running total of all my expenditures because we were living penny to penny, sometimes with no pennies. And the books were outrageously expensive back in the 70s. And we made our money to buy more books by selling our books back to the used bookstore so that we could buy more books next session or next term. And today, from the experience you've been telling us and that we're going to hear about, there's not that used textbook market anymore because of what's been going on with this bundling.
And I'm sure that's a very real problem that students are encountering, is the lack of being able to sell those books back at the end and to buy cheaper used books, both because of the frequent new editions that makes mm-hmm. the shelf life of a book much shorter, and also the bundling practices. If you cannot sell it back, and sometimes you can and sometimes you can't sell back a bundled item once you've ripped that shrink wrap off, it makes it sometimes more difficult. And I think there's a number of folks here today who can tell you from firsthand experience some of the challenges that they're seeing.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Ms. Hunt, I'm going to have you come up because I know you've got things to do. There had been some comment from the industry, and they'll come up and testify, that this bill would be unconstitutional. And so I asked Ms. Hunt to write us an opinion about that. And could you identify yourself for the record then and explain your opinion, please?
Cindy Hunt, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. The committee was in receipt of an opinion written by a private law firm based on a Connecticut bill. The committee had also received a court case from a federal circuit court in Puerto Rico. So I was asked to review the opinion on the Connecticut bill and then also the Puerto Rican case. The opinion raised two issues under the U.S. Constitution, a Commerce Clause issue and a First Amendment issue. And my conclusion, based on both of those and reviewing the Puerto Rican case, is that the bill in front of you, I think, would withstand challenge if it was challenged under either of those constitutional provisions. The other thing that, when I looked at the opinion and also the Connecticut bill, the provisions of the Connecticut bill are significantly different than the bill in front of you. The Connecticut bill was an out-and-out prohibition on textbook bundling for all retail outlets in Connecticut. So in other words, if you were a publisher with textbooks that were bundled, you couldn't sell those in Connecticut, even over the Internet, for example. Whereas the Oregon bill in front of you does not regulate other retail outfits that are not higher ed institutions, for example. It also is not an out-and-out prohibition on textbook bundling as long as they're selling them individually. So those kind of provisions were very significant differences between the two.
Okay. Okay, that's perfect. Any questions? Boy, there's a lot of orange black down here. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Isn't that a beautiful color?
Oh, it's lovely. It adorns the dais. Yes. Very nice.
Thank you. Maybe while Ms. Hunt is
at
the table, if I might ask a question with respect to the language in the bill as opposed to the constitutional issue.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Line 5 on the dash 1s references to wholesale price, and I'm wondering if that was intentional as opposed to retail, or the chain of selling, does it go through a wholesale process and then to a retail?
Chair Walker, Senator Morse, I am not necessarily an expert on publishing, but the selection of the word wholesale price as opposed to retail price is very intentional, in answer to your question.
So, if I might follow up,
mm-hmm.
if books are typically bought at retail, is the wholesale price the relevant price? Because then you're disclosing the markup for the retailer. Is that the intent of the bill?
Chair Walker, Senator Morse, the decision of whether to direct the publisher to disclose the wholesale price or the retail price is a policy decision for this committee to make. Whether you disclose either one doesn't change, like, my legal opinion or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That doesn't exactly answer your question. But I suspect there's other people in the room who are more experts on publishing that could better answer your question.
It may lead to confusion in the enforcement of the bill in the future.
Okay. Well, I'm sure Mr. Gardner is going to address that issue with you when he comes up. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, just on that point, I'm not sure how the publisher would necessarily know the retail price. That would complicate things significantly, I would think. So, because the retail price is at the discretion of the retailer, not necessarily the wholesaler. So.
Okay. Any other questions of Ms. Hunt?
There is one other thing I should add, is that although the committee didn't specifically ask me to do an opinion on the constitutionality of the Dash 1 amendments, my opinion wouldn't change with the Dash 1 amendments as well. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that you did the opinion for the committee and all the work that you do for all of us who have bills in this committee. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to call up, we're going to get quickly behind if I don't hurry up here, Megan Driver, Charles Long, and Stephen Burke. Just going to call you up in threes. If you don't know each other, shake hands and introduce yourselves and make a new friend today. Okay, and whoever sits down first gets to start first.
You said shake hands.
Yeah, nice. You just made a friend today. Okay.
All right, I'll begin. Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Megan Driver, and I am a student at Oregon State University.
Go Beavers.
Go Beavers. And I'm the chair for the Oregon Student Association Board of Directors. Good morning to all of you, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. As I'm sure most of you know, the Oregon Student Association represents over 100,000 students at Oregon's universities, community colleges, and Oregon Health and Science University in Portland. I'm here today to ask for your support on Senate Bill 365, the bill that addresses the unfair practices of textbook publishers and will help make higher education more affordable for all Oregon students. Last month, the Oregon Student Association released a report entitled, Where Are We At and Where Are We Going? This report was compiled with more than 6 months of research and data, and we surveyed over 4,000 students about the health and the current climate of higher education and the accessibility and affordability for students and the factors that they face. In this report, students were asked how much they spend on textbooks every term. University students on average said they spent $312 per term, while community college students reported spending $294 per term. On average, textbooks add almost $1,000 a year to the cost of education. And these figures are mirrored nationally. Since students were able to write in the number they spend per term, it was obvious that many knew exactly down to the dollar how much they spend every term on textbooks. Research has shown that there are two common practices of textbook publishers that have led to the increased cost that's been passed on to students. First, publishers are failing to make price and product information available to professors so that they can take this into account when they're selecting which books to use in their course. A recent survey of faculty in Massachusetts found that less than half of the faculty who regularly use publishers' websites can find this product information available on the website. Interviews with Oregon professors have found similar information. Secondly, as mentioned before, bundling materials such as DVDs, compact discs, and workbooks has led to increased price for students. For many students, the cost of bundled materials leads to price increases of 10 to 50% higher than purchasing the book alone. Without the option of purchasing only the textbook, students are left with no option but to purchase the more expensive bundled versions. Senate Bill 365 addresses each of these practices. First, the legislation would require textbook publishers to share cost and availability information with professors when they're determining which books to use for their courses. Recent research has indicated that about 40% of professors do not typically know the cost of the book they assign. Senate Bill 365 requires publishers of textbooks to clearly disclose the price of their books in any transaction, whether it be internet, sales meeting, or printed material. Numerous professors, instructors, and advocacy organizations, including the American Federation of Teachers in Oregon, support this bill. The second piece of legislation addresses the issue of bundled materials. Research has found that nearly 50% of professors whose books are bundled with additional materials by the publisher rarely use those materials. In Oregon, we work on a 10-week transfer system, and oftentimes many of those materials aren't used in that 2.5-month period. Senate Bill 365 requires publishers who offer textbooks for sale in bundles to also make them available without the bundle. Giving professors the option to choose cheaper, unbundled books if they do not require the additional materials for their course content. This bill would also require the publisher to disclose the price of the book bundled and unbundled. All in all, Senate Bill 365 is good for students. It will help make higher education more affordable at a time when students are facing record tuition increases and graduating with more debt than ever. On behalf of Oregon students, we ask you to please support and pass Senate Bill 365. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. And Ms. River, I just found one of the things that astounded me yesterday. Mm-hmm. And it's a textbook that comes wrapped with a one-time use component, such as a password to a website. And the password expires at the end of the term. And so you can't resell the book because you can't resell the password.
Yeah. So, and oftentimes professors, they're not aware how long the book is going to be available. Oftentimes textbooks will only have a picture, just a few pages changed, and the next year the student can't sell them, or at the end of the term, students aren't able to sell their books back because the textbook publisher has released a new book, and that book, whether even if there's just slight changes, is now like there's a new edition and that book's not in print anymore.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Who's next? And if your testimony is long and printed, just summarize it and we can read it.
Chairwoman Walker and members of the Senate Education and Government Committee. My name is Steve Burke, and I'm a political science major at the University of Oregon. I'm asking you to pass Senate Bill 365 because, quite simply, textbook prices are too high. They're overinflated, and the cost is pricing students right out of an education. Textbooks have risen at four times the rate of inflation since 1994, and the result is a situation such as mine, where last term I had to pay $95 for a used calculus book, or sophomore Sean Barneveld at the university, who paid $545 for a single term. The biggest reason for these exaggerated prices is because professors who choose their books go to the publishing companies who show them the books without disclosing of the prices. Then once they have a monopoly on the course, they jack up the prices for the students to pay. The proposed bill would dramatically help the situation because it would force publishing companies to disclose the prices to the professors before they chose to implement them in their courses. The second big reason that textbook prices are so high is because often you'll find the textbooks come with additionally bundled items such as CDs or pamphlets. Now, not only does this drive up the prices, but studies show that 50% of all professors rarely or never use these items. Senate Bill 365 would help this by forcing publishing companies to come up with both bundled and unbundled options for all of their textbooks, and it would require that they disclose of both of the prices to the professors. On top of the issue of prices itself, new editions come out, statistics show, every 3 to 4 years on average. This makes it hard for students to sell their books via online book swaps and other alternative sources, and forces them to go back to the bookstore to buy new editions quite often. Senate Bill 365 would help this because it would force publishing companies to disclose of the amount of time that the book will be out before a new edition comes out. Senate Bill 365 has the potential to be one of the most effective bills in the country. It would save students of higher education literally thousands of dollars, and quite simply, in my opinion, it's the right thing to do. As a university student of the great state of Oregon, I'm asking you to please approve this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. And that was the degree I got from the University of Oregon, was political science.
Oh.
So see, you can do something with that degree.
Make $1,400 a month.
That's exactly right.
But you get to help people.
There you go.
You get to help people. You absolutely. All right, you must be Mr. Long. Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the board. Last term I spent...
Your name.
Oh, my name? Sorry. My name is Charles Long, and I'm a student down at Lane Community College, and I'm also the leader of the textbook campaign in Augsburg. So last term I spent over $300 just solely on textbooks. I asked myself why I had to spend so much money on just information that I can possibly get off the internet or anywhere else. So I decided to get involved in Augsburg and to learn more. What I found out is that publishers are bundling textbooks, and making new additions to textbooks that don't necessarily need them. For new additions, for example, with that, there's a biology book that I have checked out recently. There's a third edition and a fourth edition between the two. The only difference between those two books is that there's a CD-ROM located in the fourth edition. The difference in those prices is $50. The first edition is $75. The second edition is $125. Another example is how publishers are withholding prices from faculty members when they first introduce their textbooks. I was a witness in this act of when they withheld the price. During the entire presentation, they showed the book off, they showed the pages, and all that. At the end, I asked them how much this book will cost. They looked around for a second and told me they could not give me that information. I asked why they would not give me that information, and they said they do not know at that time. Now, it is my opinion that I believe they should have that information with them when they do present a book for the first time. I believe that the Senate Bill 365 would be really good to have. If it was passed, it would help faculty members choose better textbooks that are cheaper for students and also make it easier for them to buy these textbooks.
Okay. All right. Any questions? Thank you for leading this campaign. We appreciate it. And thank you for your testimony, all of you, today. All right, I'm going to bring up three more. We're going to have to close this hearing at 20 till so I can move on to my other bills. So let's bring up Ashley Sherrick, Mark Perlman, and Michael Dembrow. Two of you are faculty, and I think one of you is a student. Ashley, why don't you go first?
Okay, good morning. Chairman Walker, members of the committee, my name is Ashley Sherrick, and I am the Journalism Education Senator for the Associated Students of the University of Oregon. I have been working closely with Osberg on the textbooks campaign also. Thank you again for your time and allowing me the opportunity to speak to you, and I am here to speak in favor and ask for your support of Senate Bill 365. As you already know, the rising cost of textbook is an exponentially growing problem for students. According to a recent report in Massachusetts, students pay $900 on books each year, which is about 20% of their tuition and fees at a four-year public university. Also, publishers capitalize on the common practice of bundling, which, as you know, is shrink-wrapping CD-ROMs, passwords, and workbooks to the textbooks, which also significantly drives up the prices. And it also, more importantly, makes it that much harder for students to be able to sell back their books on the market. Most students would rather sell and be able to sell their textbooks in the used book market because that is their main way of saving a dollar or two, and it helps keep their spending on textbooks down. Also, professors are not able to order the book they want without the bundled materials and didn't even know that an unbundled option was available because the publisher did not disclose the information. Lastly, unnecessary new editions of textbooks are issued even when there is little or no change of content from the previous edition, which also benefits the publishers and are unfair to students. Here at the University of Oregon, very few professors are educated about the unfair business practices of publishers. My journalism professor currently chooses to buy textbooks from an alternative textbook method online, and I purchased a brand new public relations book this year for $36, which was pretty decent. Also, bundled books are not eligible for buyback at the U of O bookstore, which creates the need for new books and therefore does not save students money. We need to break down the barriers to higher education and relieve the financial burden on current college students. The textbook publishing industry is capitalizing on the student market and is exponentially driving up the prices through unfair business practices. As a final note, we can help students with the passage of this bill. We can enable faculty to help students by allowing them the option to choose which book they want for their classes, as provided in a list by the publisher's agent and which is outlined in this bill. We can get rid of unnecessary textbook bundles by offering our universities the option of buying each component in the textbook bundle separately. These proactive measures will help to solve the problem and will provide immediate benefit to students and faculty and let the publishers know that students will not continue to be taken advantage of. Thank you very much for your time today and your consideration of this bill, and I really look forward to the potential passage of Senate Bill 365.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay. We've got a professor here. Tell us what happens when you assign these books.
Good morning, Chair Walker and members of the committee. I'm Mark Perlman. I'm a philosophy professor at Western Oregon University. And we're in favor of Senate Bill 365. I've had on numerous occasions the problem of trying to figure out how much a textbook would cost. And if you look on the literature, there are two sets of literature that publishers send out to bombard professors with. Specialty books usually will have the price, but textbooks are magically priceless on all the literature that we get. So then I'll look on the website to see if I can find the price, and there's no price. Then I have to start searching the web. Usually if I find Amazon.com, I can probably find out what they're selling it for. But that doesn't say what our bookstore would sell it for, because Amazon has a special deal, being a huge marketer. So I go to the bookstore on the first day of the term, and I find out how much it costs, which is sort of not very helpful when I'm trying to decide how to save my students money. One of the things that you may not know is the relatively recent phenomenon that a lot of students are going online to try and buy their books. If they can't find used copies at their bookstore, they'll go to Amazon or one of those used bookstores online. They'll order it, but then it takes a week or two for them to get it. So for the first week, sometimes 2 weeks of the term, I look out there to see if my students have their books, and they don't have books yet, some of them, because they're still, you know, books in the mail. And I totally understand why they're doing this, because the books are ridiculously expensive, and a lot of them are, you know, they're pressed to be able to afford their books. I don't begrudge them at all trying to find the cheapest source of buying their books, but it's not a very, productive way to teach, to have your class not have their books for 2 weeks because they're in the mail. And this is all a direct result of the fact that the publishers have been steadily jacking up the price. It's interesting that technology for book publishing has changed a lot in the last 5 or 10 years. And I mean, it used to be if you wanted to print a book, you had to print, you know, 1,000 copies or 10,000 copies in one run to be cost effective. But the technology now exists that they can literally program their computer. They can print one copy off the press and have it be cost effective. And they don't have to stock their warehouse with thousands of copies, because as they get their orders, they can change the production line, print 14 copies of this title. And yet, you would expect that with such kind of flexibility in the process of manufacturing these books, that we'd see the benefits in lowering of prices, that they don't have to warehouse all these books. But in fact, we see none of the savings from new technology. All we see is the prices continue to go up. So there's some kind of anti-market force at work, that the publishers know that there's a limited number of publishers and we basically don't have a lot of choices with textbooks. So one other thing that the publishers are now touting is that you can design your own textbook, pick and choose from different offerings, and they'll bind it together into a nice looking book for you. And that's all well and good, and they make this out to be a tremendous advantage for professors, except the fact that a custom book, the students can't sell back ever, because it's a custom book and it's not something that's going to be on the market. So I haven't done that simply because I don't want my students to be, I want them to keep their philosophy books forever because of, you know, intellectual reasons, but I know they won't, so.
I don't know. My bookshelf is full of all my old books.
Yeah, I still got my calculus book from freshman year, and that was a mistake. But, you know, it's really a problem that we don't, here I am making the decision what book to buy, and I don't have enough information to be able to save my students money just because of the publisher's withholding of it. I'm in favor of Senate Bill 365 because I think, I mean, I would like to see it go further, but of course we wouldn't want it to be unconstitutional or anything.
No, we wouldn't.
But it's a start.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Denborough, we're going to run behind here if we don't
I'll be quick. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Denborough. I teach writing and film studies at Portland Community College, and I'm also a member of the AFT Oregon Executive Council, and I'm the Community College Faculty Advisor to the State Board of Ed. And this problem of the ever-increasing cost of textbooks and the burden that they place on students is a real concern for us faculty. Just last year, the members of my local, the Portland Community College Faculty Federation, put together a resolution calling for positive change in this respect. And we forwarded this resolution to the AFT Oregon Convention. I think it's being passed out to you now. Where it was passed, and then last summer it was introduced at the National AFT Convention in Boston, where it was subsequently passed, and I should say enthusiastically by the delegates. This is the AFT National represents 160,000 faculty across the nation, and I think you'll see when you look at this resolution that its whereases and its therefores are very much consistent with this bill, SB 365.
Okay.
You know, in preparing for my testimony, I looked at my desk yesterday and I saw two books that I've gotten recently, and I just wanted to show them to you. These are books that I'm considering using for next year. And this first one is a really intriguing book, Reading Portland, the City in Prose. And I really like the idea of having a writing course that's focused on texts, focused on Portland. It might be different if I were teaching at OSU, but anyway. When I first looked at the book, I was a little nervous because it's pretty hefty, and it's published by the Oregon Historical Society, a specialty press, which, you know, often raises the cost of it. I looked at the back. I'm not sure why, because I know that the prices are never on the back. But then, because this is not a regular textbook, as Mark said, this is a specialty book, there actually is a price here, $26.95, which is actually pretty reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the same time, in the mail came this examination copy, The Art of Watching Films. And this is for a film studies course that I teach. I haven't even unshrunk-wrapped it yet. Of course, I have no way of knowing how much this costs. None of the literature that came from the publisher indicated how much it would cost. I went online last night to McGraw-Hill's website to find out how much it cost, and of course couldn't find it anywhere. I would need to call my representative and speak with the representative to find out the price. I did finally find out the price. I didn't go to Amazon. Actually, as it happens, McGraw-Hill has an alternative site for people who want to buy books directly from them. And I did find that it cost
$72. That book cost $72?
This is $72, right. Now, tucked in the back of the shrink wrap is
a CD-ROM.
There's a CD-ROM, which... in the old days, this book has been around for a while. I think I used the first edition. I haven't used it since. This is the seventh edition. In the early days, they would include a CD-ROM as an option for me. If I wanted to order it, it was another $15 or so if I wanted to supplement the course with it. But I'm not sure when this started. Maybe it was sometime in the last 10 years. That was no longer an option. And the company made a business decision that it would make this mandatory for all books. And, you know, thus the book is now $72.
Okay.
So, you know, I really encourage, I'm appreciative of the sponsors of this bill, and I really encourage you to pass SB 365 this session.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Denborough. I appreciate all your testimony. Okay, we're going to finish up with Jim Gardner. I'm going to be about 3 minutes, Jim, and then we've got to move on. Colleagues Gary and Dean with the Oregon Independent Colleges Association had to leave. He did leave written comments indicating that he'd like an amendment to include all higher education institutions in Oregon, including the private institutions and community colleges. So I'm not going to move the bill.
They're included in the dash one amendments.
They're in the dash one. I wonder why he didn't see that, because maybe he didn't see the dash one. Okay, great. Mr. Gardner, congratulations on your new book, and I bet it doesn't sell for $72.
Madam Chair, unfortunately not.
Is it does it have a CD-ROM and a pamphlet?
I have your first book. My husband read it thoroughly, and so I'm anxious to read your second one, because the first one is a little deep for me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for the Association of American Publishers. I would like to mention that I do have some personal experience with this issue, both as the parent of two recent college graduates, and as you mentioned, as a published author, not of a course book, but of a couple of science books, and I want to also say that as a result of that first experience, I fully empathize with the testimony you've heard about the hyper-escalation that has occurred in college costs, and which unfortunately continues to plague us. But the statistics that are presented in the whereas clauses in the bill, I really must dispute. And you'll see, for instance, and I want to spend a little bit of time on that, and then conclude by saying that if the committee is interested in moving forward with this, we do have, as was the case with the other bill that we worked on in your committee for access for handicapped kids, we do have some alternative language for your consideration that we would like to present.
Well, let me tell you, I would like to move this bill in some fashion.
Yes, ma'am.
So if you have alternative language, you need to share that with us, and you've got about 2 minutes left, and then we can have a conversation. You can have a conversation with Osberg and then get back to me. But
excellent.
Be advised that next Thursday is our last committee meeting, so this needs to be done quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The numbers that our studies have shown, and this first number comes from the College Board, is that the national spending in terms of books and supplies as a percentage of the total average cost for four-year resident students, which is the total is that average is $16,357. Books and supplies as a percentage of that is 5.8%, textbooks alone 4%. There are some additional studies that focused on, for instance, University of Oregon, your alma mater, Madam Chair, and this is for 05-06, that calculated for in-state student with room and board for someone on campus, a total of $16,062. Books and supplies as a percentage of that, 5.6%. Textbooks alone, 4%. And the source of that is the Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System. So we're not saying this is not an issue and a serious issue, but it is dwarfed by the escalating costs on the other components of higher ed.
Well, resource fees would be one of those, and we're going to be discussing that a little bit later.
Excellent, Madam Chair. The other issue that has been brought up is that there's a kind of crowd out going on of used books. In fact, there are surveys which showed that spending on used books increased by 2.1% in the academic year 05-06, and that there was not a comparable increase in spending on new textbooks. So this is a very, it'll of course vary from institution to institution, course to course, but it's a very active and aggressive market, in large part an online market, where price competition, and all you have to do to check that out is to look at Aid Books or Amazon or any number of used book, which is kind of what we did when we were shopping for college texts, and you'll find a lot of price differential. What that is in part saying, and an issue that will be addressed in our proposed amendments, is a lot of margin is attributable to the retailer. And to the extent you can get, and that, which is Senator Morris's question, to the extent you can essentially get that product directly or through an online source, you can cut that margin very substantially. And that's a resource that I think students need to be more aware of it, and their professors need to be more aware of. Bundling. Normally, materials are available separately if the adoption committee specifies that, but supplemental materials have become increasingly popular, not simply because they're being force-fed by publishers, but because a number of faculty adoption committees find them very useful. There was a recent Zogby survey, for instance, which showed that 86% of faculty members currently require or recommend the use of supplemental materials. More supplemental materials are being used because they address the individual needs of students who may require some additional preparation and help with a subject matter, and because in some cases a CD, for instance, in an economics text will provide the software and problem sets that are really required to master the subject. That's very true in the science disciplines. You can read about an issue in physics or economics, but mastering it, many educational experts are now recognizing, requires doing it, requires essentially what amounts to intellectual lab work.
But Mr. Gardner, the students and those who testified today said, why can't you just sell that a la carte and let the students and the instructors decide whether they need that instead of bundling it? You may end up charging the same amount, because you could charge $24.95 for the CD-ROM and, you know, $85 for the book, and eventually it'd be the same price. But that way students could only have to buy one or the other if the instructor doesn't need it. So,
well, Madam Chair, the process by which the decision is made as to what the textbook or the textbook package will be is a very deliberative process that involves an adoption committee, typically. Mm-hmm. So they will, that committee will make a decision normally on an institutional basis as to what the right package, whether it's a la carte or whether it is the economics text with a CD, what the right package is. And normally these materials are available a la carte, but the question is, as a matter of academic decision making, should that adoption committee be the entity that makes the decision? And that really becomes the issue. It's in part an institutional issue, and they have found that these materials are useful in terms of mastering the subject. Now, we will, I think, be able to address some of those issues in more detail in the alternative language.
Okay.
We'd like you to consider.
Okay. I'm going to have to close down because this hearing was not allowed. They didn't tell me they'd need this much time, so we didn't allow that much time. But I appreciate the testimony, and since it's going to come back with alternative language, would you please get together with the folks who are the proponents of this bill and work on the language, get back to me on the suggestion changes, and if you have any additional comments in writing, you can give those to the committee.
Will do, Madam Chair.
Okay, and Mr. Gardner, I'm going to give you this opportunity. Could you please tell us the name of your new book?
The Intelligent Universe.
Thank you. I appreciate people who have the talent to write books. I value books. And if anyone would like to learn about your book, I'm sure they can find out about it online.
And I appreciate the plug, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. All right, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 365. I'm going to go right into a public hearing on Senate Bill 928.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 928 creates the Oregon Public Interest Professional Loan Repayment Program that would be administered by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. allows the commission to enter into agreements with individuals employed in specified areas for repayment of educational loans. It appropriates monies, declares an emergency, and would take effect July 1st, 2007. The bill has the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It also has a blank on page 2, line 10.
Okay, great. And we have some honored and distinguished guests here this morning, Justice Walters and Judge Aiken.
Justice Walters, I believe.
Okay. And so do you have someone else you'd like to come up with, Judge Aiken? I don't know if she was in there. Your note to me, Mr. Manton, said that Justice Walters had to leave by 9:45. I think you meant 8:45. Had I known that, I would have taken a break and heard her testimony. So, sorry. Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you very, very much for the privilege to appear today on Senate Bill 928. My name is Ann Aiken. I am a community member of Eugene, and my address is the Federal Courthouse in Eugene. I am currently a U.S. District Court judge for Oregon. And I could talk all around this issue, but before I begin my remarks, I'd like to say on behalf of Justice Walters, who I've known throughout her career, and we were students together at the University of Oregon Law School, that Justice Walters, her emphasis today really is about access to justice. And this bill is truly about access to justice on the one hand and building communities on the other. And what I'd like to do is I could talk about this all around the issue, and I would call your attention in my written testimony to the comments by the students who had an opportunity to send me emails knowing I would be appearing here today, and some of their comments I think are more to the point about where these students are and how they're feeling in their opportunities to choose where to practice and how to practice with a law degree. What's important about this bill is it not only addresses law students and the ability to repay professional loans for law students, but more importantly, it actually addresses teachers and social workers. All three of these professions are dealing with the most fragile, underserved parts of the community and the neediest of folks, and it is a tremendous opportunity to be part of a bill with teachers and with social workers. But more importantly, my area of expertise, obviously, because my career in public service has been with the legal community, is to sort of set the stage. And I would tell you, as a parent of five children, I've had the privilege of putting five children through college, and I have two more, one in school and one still in high school. So I can look at this issue as a parent. I can look at this issue as a judge on the bench for 20 years, almost 19 years going on 20. I can look at this from the standpoint of in 1979 when I graduated from the University of Oregon Law School. I had a $10,000 debt that had me hyperventilating for tuition. I worked throughout law school to go through law school, and I came out and I took a job with a district with the, at that time it was the Circuit Court of the State of Oregon for Lane County. I had the privilege of taking one of those public service jobs at the salary that was offered at that date. I would tell you that salary really hasn't changed in 30 years.
We're 50th in the nation now.
That's correct.
I think we'll be 51st behind Puerto Rico here pretty soon.
And as a law clerk to an underfunded and underpaid judge, you can only imagine what we were paid, and it barely covered what our living expenses were. But I took that job 30 years ago, and it was the start of a lifetime, and it was a commitment to public service. Today, 30 years later, the law students are still taking those jobs when they can, mm-hmm. but they're leaving law school with debts of $100,000. The example in my testimony I'd like to call your attention to is a student that I know very well. He came to law school with no debt, having a struggle to pay his undergraduate education. He received $20,000 in student loans. His father was actually served time in prison, and his mother had a minimum wage job, so he never had really any help from his family to go to school. He came to the University of Oregon. He graduated a semester early, so he's been out of school since January, and he's $75,000 in debt, and he's leaving the state of Oregon. This bill is about brain drain. The University of Oregon, along with Lewis and Clark and Willamette, were losing students out of state because students cannot afford to stay in the state and take public interest jobs, either at legal aid or in a district attorney's office as an assistant or as a public defender or in any kind of public service job, make a living and pay off $100,000 in student debts. The average student debt as of 2005, referenced in the Oregon State Bar Journal, was $80,000. That's the average. Mm-hmm. I have law students who are working for me, and I've, trust me, in my career on the federal bench, I've had 70 externs come through my office, which means they work full-time for a semester in my office and get credit. So they're paying tuition. They're working for free. That's their public service, because at least they will get 3 months of serving in the public, because they cannot afford to take those jobs when they come out. They have to take jobs. They're trading off their opportunity to come to law school and work for the neediest and work for those who are underserved, and realizing at the conclusion of their time in law school, they don't have any choice. They have to take a job that pays off that debt. So I would tell you, this bill is the start. This is an opportunity to do what the medical profession has done for years, and that is to allow medical students the opportunity to do public service, have their debts repaid, and they serve the parts of the state and the communities that are underserved. And I, if I could briefly just call your attention to my last paragraph before I reference this, those students, I would tell you that this bill, this framework, this opportunity, this what I would say infrastructure for maintaining core professional opportunities for this state, it gives you the chance to set up a framework that allows a student to take a job as a social worker in Klamath Falls, you know, a prosecutor in Harney County, a teacher in an underserved part of a tribal unit, to come into Multnomah County and to go into a job that gives them a chance to do public service and do law school and do a profession that not only allows them to serve the community in a way that provides leadership within the community, but to really give them the ability to put their passions to work. When you ask people to come out of law school and take a job where they simply are afraid they just have to make those debts every month, they essentially become what I would call almost white-collar slaves. They don't have any choices. Mm-hmm. And the legal profession is a very difficult profession. It is a hard job to bear the responsibility of people on your back and to put them in a situation where they're taking jobs that literally do not give them the opportunity to be successful, happy, or live in economic fear. They're not going to be successful. And we see that because my area of expertise before I went on the bench is family law. And I can only tell you how many divorces I was able to walk through with professionals who were miserable in the jobs they had taken because they never really had the opportunity to do what they wanted to do. And we had a high rate of incidents of drug and alcohol abuse and people not in touch with their families and working way too hard and not having balance and very unhappy. That's 30 years ago. Today, the law students are coming out of law school without choices. And I would just as soon have our professional core individuals in the jobs that give them the opportunity to not only use their incredible legal training for purposes that make them feel like they're contributing and doing meaningful work and being part of the community, but not having to take jobs simply to pay off $100,000, $120,000, and $130,000 in debt. And I would tell you honestly, in talking with my own children, I've told them that I don't know that I would make that same decision to go to law school under the same circumstances, knowing I'd come out with that kind of debt, and the inability to choose where I would get to serve my time, because having been a part of public service in this state for 30 years and chosen that career path, I don't know that I could have afforded to do that under the circumstances these students are offering. So it's a brain drain for Oregon. It's an opportunity to build an infrastructure for the most needy, and the services that are provided by educators, social worker, and lawyers serving the public good. And if we want to provide access to justice, you have to have people out there who really care enough to deliver the very, very best and to give them the opportunity to serve. So thank you very much for the privilege to be here and be a part of this legislation.
Thank you, Judge Aiken. And when this idea came to me from Senator Prozonsky's office, I think Jonathan here has been a real big supporter of it. I was just tickled about it because you're right. And we've heard it. Senator Cruz and I serve on the Judiciary Committee, and we've heard about the lawyers who work very long hours in family law and get very low pay. Our public defenders get like $40 an hour. I mean, come on. These people have a law degree, and they're getting $40 an hour. That's what I make as a court reporter. And, you know, mine's a professional degree, too, but these people are much more talented in their area of work, and they do public service. This is public service work. And you can't pay back those college loans at $40 an hour.
What Justice Walters would tell you is access to justice means having good lawyers.
Right.
Having people who understand the system. It is a privilege and a pleasure and so much easier as a judge when we have lawyers who are highly skilled and appearing in front of us that know the law and know how to move a case and solve a problem. Our job is so much easier when we have people who are not able to do that and are simply drawn to that because that's all they're able to do or that's, you know, that's their calling and they're struggling to make it work. It's not fair to the litigant. It's a difference. And what this bill allows you to do is give, for example, say Klamath Falls needs to hire a legal aid attorney. You could have someone, a really highly skilled person, go down to Klamath Falls and have their loans repaid for several years, build some expertise, and decide maybe to stay in that community because they have a chance to come down there and feel welcome and do good work. It's a way to serve this state that's very underserved with great legal services. And it's a chance to take communities and give lawyers who would like to have a chance to go out there and work but cannot pay their loans at the rate across the board in that community that they're offering for services to pay lawyers. Mm-hmm. It's an opportunity for law firms then to have someone come into the community and sort of bring them in and build the infrastructure of the legal community of a particular area. The growth in this state, and I, as the district judge, I serve and have chambers and hear cases in Portland, I'm in Medford, I'm in Pendleton, I'm in Central Oregon, and I'm in Eugene. I can tell you the difference in the ability to have good lawyers in those communities makes the cases so much easier. And when I talk to law students, most of them are thinking they're going to take a big job in Portland because that's their only choice.
Mm-hmm. The Portland
and those
market.
Jobs are yeah. few and far between.
Yeah. Senator Cruz has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, a couple, and I'll try to bundle them. The first one being, you referenced the loan program we have for doctors, which I fully support. But one of the criteria we have in that program is time of service, and I don't see that referenced in the bill. I think that would be a good addition. And you can comment on that. But the other one is I'm looking at knowing the shortage we have of lawyers, and I'm looking at the list, and I think the 50 that would be eligible could be all used up in legal aid and PD, and wondering why we've expanded it beyond that, because that's where the crying need is, in my opinion.
First, I reference the medical model because most people are familiar with that that model. And I don't have any, I did not participate in the drafting of this. I will tell you I was a participant in the creation of the University of Oregon's loan repayment program that took us 10 years to get organized, and 40 law students really drove that debate. Mm-hmm. And we looked at all the programs across the country, and we are so far behind other communities. I'll tell you that's an issue. But we have all that research should you choose to look at this and add those issues and those obligations. No problem. I think longer term, more experience, giving people the commitment to stay is a good idea. I don't have a problem with that. And secondly, the need is huge. The need is huge. And it's just the beginning of building that infrastructure. And I can tell you the enthusiasm and the opportunity to build this over time, I think, is there and can be creative. But it's money ahead because, again, if you're able to put better lawyers in the courtroom and solve problems, we reduce other kinds of expenses. And you're not necessarily going to be able to see it on an accounting sheet, but we're going to be able to see that happen in better work done all across the system.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just to follow up, quite simply, with the medical program for physicians and nurse practitioners, the time and service is kind of a critical component, because what we find over time is if the debt load is reduced to the point where they can actually make a living, time in community, they tend to want to stay because they develop relationships. And so that was why I was referencing that component that is not present in this bill, and I think it's something that maybe should be considered. And the other one, Madam Chair, quite simply is when we're talking about the need in the dependency system and other systems for in the public defender's office, I would like to see us driving specifically in that direction. But
Senator Cruz, I couldn't agree more with you, and I believe that in my talking to law students who come here, I tell them, go out into the outlying parts of the state. Your opportunity is, number one, for excellent legal work, and the chance to be a part of a community is tremendous. And so I encourage that. So the chance to get students to stay longer and build those relationships is an excellent, excellent idea. And the University of Oregon program actually encourages that, and we have it factored in. And number two, I served as the juvenile judge for Lane County for 2 years, and I was here last night at the reception for both CASA and the Relief Nursery. And my real true passion is early intervention for children, and those children are not being served well in the system. So this is just the beginning, but it's really long overdue, and we really need it both for lawyers, teachers. I'd much rather have my children need the best teacher than ever need a lawyer, but that's important, as well as a social worker, because right. social workers solve problems. So it is really building an infrastructure mm-hmm. of professional course for the rest of the state.
Okay. Great. Well, let's hear from some of the other guests.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name is Jen Geiger. I'm a third-year law student at the University of Oregon. I didn't realize it was Oregon State Day. I would have worn something green to, you know, represent my school. Sorry. I'm very pleased to be here today speaking on behalf of Senate Bill 928. I am the student chair of the fundraising committee for the University of Oregon School of Law Loan Repayment Assistance Program. It's a program that's really only been funded enough to actually give awards for a couple of years. We gave our first awards 2 years ago, but we can only fund two students each year. Currently, 40% of University of Oregon School of Law graduates go into public service, 40% of a class of approximately 175 students. Two awards is just simply not enough. We're dependent upon private donations to try and, you know, raise money for that program and expand the program. But also, you know, the state is just much better situated to cover that, and also to support social workers and teachers as well, all doing public service. I am speaking primarily from the perspective of a law student today. I'm also an Oregon native. I grew up in Portland, and I would like to make my career here in Oregon, just like many social workers and public school teachers who graduate from Oregon schools. I went away to the East Coast for my undergrad, and I worked in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia for various nonprofits and public policy organizations, and it was a difficult decision for me to decide to come back to the University of Oregon. My family is here in Oregon. I would like to stay here if I can. But I knew that my choice would be a difficult one, because salaries in Oregon are simply not up to par with other states, with working for, you know, federal agencies or nonprofits in Washington, D.C. And my undergraduate loan debt is approximately $25,000. I haven't added up lately what my law school debt is. It's a little bit depressing, so I try not to do that. But it's already at least $70,000, because I had to total it last year for my scholarship applications. Mm-hmm. So I'm facing almost $100,000 in debt. My roommate will be a clerk for Lane County Circuit Court, like Judge Aiken was. She'll be making $29,600 next year. I did a little math yesterday, probably not exact, but I tried to figure it out. So her monthly take-home pay is approximately $1,700, $1,700 to $1,800. The average loan debt, as Judge Aiken said, is $80,000 for a new lawyer in the state of Oregon. A 10-year loan on that, the monthly payments are $920. For a 25-year loan, it's $591. So my roommate is looking at paying more for rent, or more for her loan payment, than she will be for rent. Mm-hmm. That's fully, you know, a third of her salary will be just going to loan payments if she's willing to pay it off for 25 years.
Which is what I think a number of students choose, simply because they can't afford those high payments in the early years, right. And then they can, you know, pay more later. But yeah, it's difficult.
So many people do tend to lump all law students together. We come to law school to make a lot of money, to work for the big firms. But the fact is that in Oregon, approximately two-thirds of new lawyers actually make less than $50,000. The limit, I believe, in Senate Bill 928 is $45,000, mm-hmm. and doing public service. So this is able to help a lot of students. I know it's listed right now, I think, at 50 students in social work, public school teaching, and in law. But those 50 students will go a long way toward helping our graduates stay in the state. Talented, motivated people who want to do public service will have career options. I know several of other students at the University of Oregon who right now it's third year. We're all looking for jobs. Everyone is nervous. But most public interest jobs actually don't hire until after you pass the bar. and many students are looking at their loan burden and taking any job they can get at this point because they're afraid to graduate without a job, to look at passing the bar. What am I going to do come October if, you know, the five spots at Metro Defenders are full? What am I going to do? So Senate Bill 928 is going to help us keep talented and motivated teachers, social workers, and lawyers in our state. It's actually even a better investment, I think, than scholarship programs for higher education because the students who graduate from Oregon schools must do their service in the state of Oregon. The benefit of this program is that it's people graduating from Oregon schools, doing work in Oregon, serving the underserved populations of the state of Oregon. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. On behalf of Senate Bill 928, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for the work you did at the law school on the loan program. I remember hearing about that from my judges that I work for, and they were talking about it as well. Thank you. Mr. Manton, we're going to run out of time, so why don't you just give me the highlights so we can have all these other people testify.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Walker and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm legislative assistant for Senator Floyd Prezonsky. And in the interest of time, I'll just say that obviously we support this bill, and I will yield the rest of the time to let other people speak. I'd be happy to work with Senator Cruz and others on the points that you just made, and I don't think there's anything there that we would have any problems with.
No, I'm sure it should be an easy fix.
Yes.
Okay, and I'd like to get that fixed and then move the bill to Ways and Means. So if you can get that done quickly, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Judge Aiken. It's so much a pleasure to have you here, and please extend my apologies to Justice Walters. Okay, I'm going to bring up a dynamic threesome. Pete Shepard, Kevin Neely, you can shake hands, and Ann Christian. Oh, I didn't know Senator Brown was here.
That's okay. I'll just be a me too, Senator Walker, members of the committee. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown represent Portland and Milwaukee. Very much in support of this bill. Thank you for taking your time out of your busy schedule to hear it. I spent last year practicing at Juvenile Rights Project, a firm of lawyers committed to advocacy for children both in the courtroom and in the classroom. And we lost more than one lawyer during the year that I was there because they had to go on to higher paying jobs. I will tell you, after my bar number is an 85 bar number, I was making $2,000 half-time at Juvenile Rights Project, and the only way I could afford to do it, frankly, is because I had this other fabulously paying legislative gig and a very supportive partner. But these are folks who are extremely committed to representing children, and we need to make sure that these folks can keep doing the kind of work they can do, and if they have huge loans coming out of law school, they simply can't afford to do it. So thank you and all.
Well, thank you, Senator Brown. I'm glad you mentioned that because we brought it up, because Senator Cruz, as you know, has been working with you on the dependency legislation this session, and I remember the testimony in the Judiciary Committee not too long ago about that, and so that was the first thing that came to my mind. So
thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, all right, so Pete, Kevin, and Ian, come on up. Are you guys still speaking to each other?
Well, he doesn't talk to me, but I talk to him.
Yeah, just for those out in TV land who don't know, Mr. Neely used to work with Mr. Shepard, and he moved on to other employment, and I think everyone misses him.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. The Department of Justice is among the state's largest law firms. I wouldn't have spent the last 20 years with that law firm if I didn't think that practice at the department was the most interesting, the most challenging, and the most rewarding form of public service that any lawyer can aspire to. We're very proud of the lawyers at the Department of Justice and of all of the staff there. And yet we face a daily and growing challenge to recruit and retain the best and the brightest for public service in this state and in the service of Oregonians. We routinely compete against firms that are able to offer the entry-level positions at the Department of Justice twice what our entering salary level is. And that, of course, is an even greater gradient with some of the other forms of public service that you've heard about already this morning and you'll hear a little more about momentarily. Sometimes we're successful in that competition, but increasingly the staggering debts that those graduates face force them to make choices to go into private practice that they would prefer not to make, that they would prefer to be in public service and are willing to pay a significant penalty in order to serve the public, but it just gets to the point where if they're as smart as we want them to be to hire them at the Department of Justice, they can't make any decision other than to take the higher paying job to pay off these staggering debts. If we're to sustain the tradition of excellence that we have at the department and continue to be as competitive as we are for the best and the brightest, we're going to need your help. This bill I would characterize as a stand-up double, as is. It's a very good step in the right direction. All Oregonians are going to benefit from the kind of public service that the bill, even the printed bill, would facilitate and enable. In our judgment, it would be a triple with a slight change to the provisions of the bill. The current threshold for eligibility for the benefit provided in the bill is slightly below what the Department of Justice entering salary is. And although, in my judgment, the department's lawyers would be eligible for the benefit under the provisions of line 9 on page 1 of the bill, because our organization is one that is engaged in public service and the list of specific entities listed is not an exclusive list, nonetheless, as printed, the bill would exclude the Department of Justice from this benefit by virtue of the minimum threshold requirement. So we'd encourage you to consider a modification to the bill that would take in at least the first step of our salary range.
Okay.
In addition, as to Senator Cruz's suggestion of time and service, that seems like a sensible thing to add to the bill, and we would support that.
All right. Terrific. I'll let Mr. Manton know. Ms. Christian, we're going to save Mr. Neely for last because he's neutral.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ann Christian, and I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And prior to representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, I did serve as the Director of Indigent Defense Services for the state of Oregon for 15 years. I've been away from that position now 3 years, and I can tell you during my 15-year tenure that it was an extreme difficulty to attract attorneys into the public defense field. As was mentioned earlier, the rate of pay for those attorneys who don't have a contract, who do the work on an hourly rate basis, has been $40 per hour since 1991. Contract attorneys, so what you may think of as the traditional public defenders in the metropolitan area, we have three public defenders. One is Juvenile Rights Project that Senator Brown worked with. The other two, Metropolitan Public Defender and Multnomah Defenders, Inc., have starting salaries of $38,000. I currently serve on the board of Multnomah Defenders, and the board and the director made a conscious effort with limited funds this most recent year to increase that entry-level salary. And in large measure, it is a result of the student loan debt that kids are coming out of school with today. When I attended law school, I was able to do it for $1,000 a year at a good state institution, and that has not been the case for years and years and years. So we are thrilled. Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers is absolutely thrilled with Senate Bill 928. And, Madam Chair, with your permission, my partner, as far as legislative representation, she and her husband graduated from the University of Oregon, and with your permission, if she could give you just a brief personal example of what it is to come out of school and try to practice public defense law.
Okay, after we'll make you do the switcheroo, and I'll hear from Mr. Neely. I've got to hurry up because we've got three more bills Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The Oregon District Attorneys Association does strongly support this bill. We agree with Mr. Shepard that it would be nice to see the threshold increased, because that would catch, if we were at the same level as the first tier of Oregon District of DOJ attorneys, that would scoop in all of the DA offices around the state, the entry-level DAs. Right now, at the $45,000 threshold, it scoops in about half of the district attorney's offices. Their starting salary is at that $45,000 or lower threshold. Again, I only echo the comments of those who have spoken before me. The individuals who are engaging in this sort of public attorneying are making a lifestyle decision that has dramatic impacts on their families. throughout the course of their family's lives. They could take a $150,000 job, or they can take a $50,000 job, and over the course of the time it takes them to pay that debt, it costs these individuals $1 million, $100,000 a year over those 10 years. I think we can all agree that sacrifice they believe is worth making for the public, but it has extraordinary ramifications on their families. This is one step forward in equalizing the playing field as much as we can. I think the other step is one that others have often talked about, particularly as it relates to the public defenders. We also need to get the salary at the right spot. So this is one piece of a two-part puzzle.
Okay. So I'll ask you to work with Mr. Manton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy L. Konich, and I work for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I very strongly wanted to talk about this bill. I'm a graduate of the University of Oregon Law School. My husband graduated University of Oregon Law School. We were both public defenders, and I've had the unique opportunity to work at Multnomah Defenders, Metropolitan Public Defenders, and for the Public Defense Consortium in different job positions, one as law student and also as an attorney. I can tell you that when I graduated law school, I made $37,000 at the public defender's office. My husband was making the same salary at the public defender's office. When I worked for the consortium, I made $35,000. I can't even believe I'm saying it out loud, quite frankly, because it sounds like so little at this point after graduating law school. I can tell you that when we decided to have a family, we could not do it on our two salaries at the public defender's office. It just wasn't possible. So my husband, who was a talented... Well,
one of you had to take a real job.
And that's exactly how the conversation went. My husband, who is a talented and passionate attorney and still happens to love his job at where he is now, but who was very dedicated to public defense, had to leave the public defender's office so we could actually have a child and buy a house. While we were at the public defender's office, his loan was in deferment, so we could pay on one of our loans. It was, quite frankly, pathetic. After having graduated law school and, you know, my husband graduated in the top 5% of his class and could have taken another job out of law school, but chose to do that because he believed strongly in the cause. And I know you've heard testimony like this before, but one of the big issues for the criminal defense lawyers are that we have a graying of the population. It's incredibly difficult for us to sway excited and passionate and young attorneys to take this job, even when they believe in it very strongly, because they simply cannot afford to do it. And we are excited to see this bill. We hope that it will address some of the needs that young public defenders have. And we thank you for this opportunity, letting me share my personal story. I don't usually get to that when I testify. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Konich. I appreciate hearing that side of you. Because in judiciary, we hear all the the stuff that you represent for your client. And that's good and that's okay, but it's nice to get the personal.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, we need to shut this hearing down at 9:30. I've got two people, Jefferson Smith and Brett Rolette. Come on up. Appropriately dressed, so you gained admission into the committee today.
Notice Pete Shepard didn't get the memo, did he?
He did not. Okay.
Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. My name is Jefferson Smith. I'm with the Oregon Bus Project and a resident of Portland, here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 928. In the interest of time, I've deleted some of the conversation about the practice of law, which I went to law school, was trained as a lawyer, but instead to focus on a couple of the other professions. But to open with a sort of our motivation in thinking about this bill and wanting this to be a category of issues that we work on over time. A board member of ours, who some of you know, Representative Ben Cannon, is one of Oregon's not very many Rhodes Scholars. And in the early 60s and 70s, majority of Rhodes Scholars went into public service. In his mid-90s Rhodes Scholar class, the plurality of graduates went to McKinsey & Company, the management consulting firm. Right? Good firm, but it doesn't necessarily address some of our public interest concerns. Harvard Kennedy School of Government in the 1970s sent 75% of the graduates to public service. In the late 90s, they sent just one-third. This underlines a major problem facing the public interest. How do we encourage people to engage in public interest careers, particularly with an education finance system working against us and a job market making public interest work less attractive? In the early 1970s, a graduate student faced roughly the same first-year salary if they went to a New York, you know, Wall Street law firm or if they became a public school teacher. Right now, that first-year gap is about 4 or 5 to 1. Over 5 years, usually is an order of magnitude. Oregon Student Association survey this year showed that our students graduating with a four-year degree carry an average debt of over $19,000, nearly $20,000. A 2006 report released by the state PIRGS Higher Education Project indicated that 23% of students graduating from four-year institutions nationwide are effectively priced out of work as a teacher, while 37% could not afford to start as social workers. Too often we face a debate about higher education versus other public services, and this may be the most helpful point I have. I think this bill, and hopefully the broader conversation in this realm, could help us subsidize some of our important public services and also fund higher education. It's a chance to nourish two birds with one nut. For interest of time, I'll cut off the rest of my testimony, but thanks very much for your leadership on the issue.
Thank you. Mr. Roulette, you know, our next hearing is going to cut into your time.
Good morning, Chair Walker.
And we like this bill.
Exactly. For the record, Brett Roulette, Legislative Director with OSA. I've submitted written testimony, and I'll let that say everything I was hoping to say today. OSA supports Senate Bill 928.
Thank you. And I did leave off Jacob Werblau, who has shown up at the dais.
Yeah. Sir. Thank you. I'm Jacob. I'm here to represent the teachers, University of Oregon. I'm a third-year doctoral student myself there, finishing up. I just wanted to give you a brief snapshot of what some of our future teachers are experiencing in terms of personal debt right now. I'll just briefly just give you some numbers, $30,000 of debt. A single parent father, $21,000 of debt. $40,000, $50,000, $40,000, $40,000, and $60,000, a single-parent mother. That's just a few, and I can turn these into you. These are personal statements, which I emailed this morning as well. Sort of the unfortunate thing about educators is that we don't have the choice to sort of sell ourselves to a higher-paying position unless we leave the profession. I'll just very briefly in this sense of time, I'll just take another few seconds, just tell you a little bit about myself. I, however, did not experience a lot of personal problems with debt. I was a teacher in California, and they have a statewide program where they'll pay off your loans every year that you stay in a low-performing school. And this is called the Apple Loan Repayment Program, and they cover tens of thousands of teachers every year. They personally covered $10,000 of my personal loans, and that was really helpful. My partner, on the other hand, she was raised by a carpenter and a house cleaner. She is very, very gifted. She was accepted to Stanford and turned it down because she wanted to come to the U of O to get a credential in teaching administration. She started teaching last year, high school teacher, Spanish, in Drain, Yonkala, Southern Oregon. She was making $24,000 a year, and she had over $60,000 in personal debt. So maybe that'll balance out because we stay together. But that's sort of what I'm inheriting. But it's worth it. So it is bittersweet. I have to say it is bittersweet for me to be here today. I think this is a great bill, but we really need something a lot more substantial, and I think we all could agree on that. And even though I'm almost, I'll be finishing my degree this summer, I still can't figure out how Cuba can cover all their citizens and we can't, but this is a good step in the right direction. So thank you for your time, and we went a minute over.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate all your testimony. Mr. Manton, you know what you need to do. Get us those amendments. We'll stick this on for the 26th. That's going to be our day to do cleanups for all these bills that suddenly need amendments. And we may, colleagues, have to start at 7:30 that morning.
Madam
Chair, get it all done.
If the amendments are right, we'd just go into work session past this.
Okay. All right, great. Well, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 928, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1029, correct?
correct, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 1029 requires the State Board of Education to study and report on the impact of differential tuition on different groups of students. It requires the board to create a committee at each state of institution of higher education to recommend a process and criteria for increasing and creating programmatic resource fees. It requires the board to include the cost of programmatic resource fees and the cost of education. It freezes programmatic resource fees until these duties are completed. The bill declares an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2007.
Okay. And we don't have a sign-up sheet. What happened to it? Our sign-up sheet disappeared.
Sorry. Please have Melissa start, and then I'll see what I can
do. Okay. Melissa, do you have anyone else that you want to bring up with you? Just bring them up until we figure out where the sign-up sheet went. Sometimes it accidentally gets put in somebody's briefcase. That's the second time that's happened this session. Okay, and we're going to have to go till 10:15, colleagues, but that doesn't mean you get more time because we've got two other bills. So,
thank you, Chair Walker, and members of the committee. I'll try to keep this short. I submitted written testimony.
Thank you.
And with me are Jared Axelrod and Mike Olson, who will talk about U of O and OSU specifically.
Okay.
But I just wanted to give you a quick overview of what has brought OSA to bring this bill before you today. Did I introduce myself? I don't think I did. I'm Melissa Unger, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Association. For the past 4 years, the Oregon Student Association has testified in front of the Oregon University System Board regarding the use of programmatic resource fees. And what programmatic resource fees is there? Pretty much an additional fee for a major or a department. So, for instance, a freshman at the University of Oregon pays $700 for the Honors College each term to be in the Honors College, or an engineering student at OSU pays $433 to be an engineering student per term. And the fees range from $433 to be an engineering student at OSU to, you know, $20 to be in the School of Science at Southern Oregon University. And we've, like I said, we've testified in front of the OUS board about this issue for years, and we really feel like we just haven't been heard. In 2005, 2006, there were 19 new programmatic resource fees approved at different schools throughout the system, and I included in what I gave you a list of each when the fees were approved as they came up since around 1996. In 1996, there were 6 programmatic resource fees, and today there's over 55 at the different institutions.
It's become a cash cow, hasn't it?
I mean, it does bring in around $13 million into the system. And, you know, I want to acknowledge, and I think the most important thing to acknowledge is, I don't necessarily blame the university system for all of this. A lot of this has to do with declining state support, but we don't think that this is the answer. Is nickel and diming students through these fees that there's little information about, that they don't necessarily report back to the legislature, and that students can't really incorporate into their cost of education. And so we, in the bill, there's six components, and the first one is that it will, their differential tuition, before they can implement a differential tuition policy, which we think this is, but it's kind of not quite there. It hasn't been called differential tuition. It's still called resource fees. Before we move to that, or before there's any further discussion about it, that they have to report back on what it actually would do to different populations of students, looking at what it would do to low-income students, if it would change their enrollment patterns. And through some research, there's this differential tuition is used in a couple of other states, and Milwaukee's about to do a review of differential tuition to see how it's impacted their enrollment patterns there, and so there'll be some new information coming out soon and that we could use here in Oregon before we fully implemented this model. Two, it would make sure that each campus has a process and a criteria for approving these fees. Right now, there's no system-wide policy on how they get approved, and on some campuses are very good at including students, other campuses are not as good, so we'd like to make sure that each campus has a process and criteria for why fees get chosen, what fees get approved, and then at the same time, there's a system-wide policy that would make sure that the campus's policy fit into that system-wide policy. The next is that it requires that they're published in the World Wide Web and other publications. We want to make sure that students know about these fees. We hear often about students who have a $150 charge that they had no idea about, that they had not budgeted for, and so that's just the goal of making sure that all the fees are visible. And, like, again, certain campuses are better at it than other campuses, but we just want to make sure it's uniform across the system.
Well, Ms. Unger, I did have a conversation with the University of Oregon, and they indicated that as a result of this bill, they were going to make it more clear on their web-based system what those fees are, that they were there, but they were very difficult to find. So already you have made some change, so that's good.
Actually, exactly. We've actually been working with a committee to make some of those changes already. And then we were also trying to include this in the cost of education. And right now, students can go to their financial aid office once a fee is charged to get their financial aid package recalculated. But for those students, there's no more aid outside of grants available. But with the passage of the shared responsibility model, it's much more price sensitive. And so a student who's charged $700 more would actually get more of a grant. And so we want to make sure there's a way to include some of these fees in the cost of education that can help those students get grant aid to cover some of the costs of these fees, because some of them are so large. Mm-hmm. And then in addition, we'd like to work with the university system to set up a fee remission or a scholarship to cover students who actually can show that they have financial hardship to pay these fees. And all of this would be required before they could increase any resource fees. And I think that the idea of this is we understand that the university system is in a crisis. They need additional revenue. The co-chair's budget is not adequate to make sure that they get the additional revenue to not need these fees. But we do think that at the same time, this doesn't cut any of their revenue out. We wanted to make sure that we understand they can't lose any money. So this just requires certain things of the university system before they can further increase their fees. And you know, we've been working with the university system, as Chair Walker just mentioned, to actually kind of come to some solution on some of these problems now. Since the bill's been introduced, we've set up a committee. We really appreciate working with this committee. We think it's going very well. We're working on the research on differential tuition, as well as looking at ways to make it more transparent, and we hope that that process continues. But we still feel like this bill is necessary because we don't think There's not been an agreement on capping resource fees or on setting up a fee remission, and so we think those two pieces of the bill are important, as well as, you know, we haven't seen a lot of progress on this issue over the last 4 years, so we'd like to make sure that that progress continues, and we think this bill lays out a good plan on how that progress can continue.
Okay.
And so those are kind of my comments, and then I'm going to turn it over to them.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Walker, members of the committee. My name is Jared Oxford. I'm the president of the Associated Students of the University of Oregon.
Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
It is OSU Day. I'm sorry.
I didn't bring my tie, but May 14th is U of O Day, so
I know.
Make sure you wear your green and yellow.
Okay.
So thank you once again for affording me the opportunity to speak today on Senate Bill 1029. Universities across the state, programmatic resource fees are popping up all over the place. These fees, as you know, are being seen as backdoor tuition increases, where tuition has been frozen so that it can't increase a certain amount, and yet the university system and university administration are still charging students fees, which are technically tuition, but these fees assessed to different majors and departments, which, you know, have been occurring more recently now. These fees are detrimental to students for various reasons. First, justifications for these new fees are often very ambiguous and vague, denying students the ability to know where exactly their funds are going. And that's something that I feel is very important, that students should know. If they're asked to pay a certain amount, pay hundreds of thousands of dollars each year, they should at least know where their money's going and what it's being spent on. And also, description of these fees are not really available, which, you know, decreases the amount of transparency. Second, because these fees are generally assessed on a term-by-term basis, like Melissa said, they're not calculated into a student's financial aid package, making it very nearly impossible for students to plan accordingly with these fees. And because a lot of students are on very tight budgets, planning for these unplanned fees oftentimes does not happen.
Actually, Mr. Axelrod, I did in my conversation with the University of Oregon, they indicated they do compute programmatic resource fees in the financial aid package, but not all schools do that.
No.
So again, it's the consistency issue that Ms. Unger's talking about, and how do you know it's being factored in at your school?
Certainly. And that's part of the benefits with this bill, is that it will help create that uniformity across all the campuses across the
Great.
State. And like I was saying, third, changes in resource fees do not involve students, and this adequate system of shared governance is really not happening when deciding the level of these fees and creating an insufficient process in creating a fair tuition policy. So speaking at the personally at the U of O, students being charged for fees for nearly everything on campus, everything from education majors being charged $50 a term to business majors $160 a term. Myself and my vice president, Juliana Guzman, went on the campaign trail last spring talking to students about resource fees. I was talking to one undeclared student. He said, "Well, I don't have any fees. I'm an undeclared student." I said, "Well, yes, you do."
So yes, it's, you do.
So it's a lot of the things that, you know, students don't know that they're being charged these fees.
And if you double major, you get charged double.
Even more, exactly. And, you know, I was looking on my own bill last night, on my tuition bill last night. I saw something on there that just said mandatory fee. That's it. No link, no further description, just mandatory fee of $45. Also, a lot of schools are now front-loading fees so that, for example, the Honors College fees, there's a higher amount for freshman and sophomore years as opposed to the junior senior years, knowing that a lot of students will drop out. So they collect those fees from students, a higher portion of fees from those students towards their beginning of their tenure there. So dialogue has been engaged now that, you know, resource fees are being talked about. At the OUS level, myself, Melissa, and Mike here have been talking with various administrators from campuses across the state as well as OUS personnel to help increase the transparency of these fees and help find a solution. Like I said, we're working to increase transparency of these fees, making them more accessible to students that they know what's going on, reviewing current fees to see how they came to be and the process that they went through, as well as researching a differential tuition model and the effects of eliminating all programmatic resource fees altogether. This bill will, however, assist the OUS system in future resource fee discussions. So, Chair Walker, members of the committee, thank you very much, and I urge you to support and pass Senate Bill 1029.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Olson, please, I'm not going to have time for you to read your testimony, so just summarize it for us, because we're running out of time.
All right.
This is Buck Bias here.
No. No. I'm proud to support the university in all parts of the state.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and special recognition to those distinguished alumni from OSU. My name is Mike Olson. I am the current student body president at OSU for another couple weeks here. And I think Jared and Melissa have done a great job of really testifying to what students are going through. I think one piece that hasn't been touched on is the whole reason that the resource fees were even created to start with, and that goes to the lack of funding at a state level.
Mm-hmm.
And the creativity of the Oregon University system to create additional revenue within the system without calling it tuition. That's where we really developed these course resource fees.
I love your description, creativity.
Creativity, I think that's the best way to describe it.
Senator Cruz passed me a note and said, do we review and approve these fees in the legislature, and we don't.
I'm sure it's going to be one of the few public entities where we don't do that, I would think.
And I know that when we had an energy crisis, that all the campuses imposed some energy supplemental fee. And last time I looked, there were a couple of institutions still charging that, and I believe the U of O was one of them.
Mm-hmm. And really, the first fee started at the U of O with a technology fee. And as far as I'm concerned, I didn't realize that technology was never a part of our education. That was an additional fee or a perk that we had to create within our system. And so overall, I had a different number than Melissa of $36.5 million within the system.
That is a total amount of fees,
okay.
Not just programmatic resource
okay.
fees. Programmatic resource fees is around $13 million.
Okay, so $13 million within programmatic resource fees, but as you can see, we paid additional fees in the amount of $36.5 million. And all too often, we are discussing the current trend of increasing cost of tuition and higher education as a whole. So I think it's extremely important for us to address this within the system to provide greater access and ability for students to fiscally plan as they enter into our universities. Take, for example, a first-year engineering student this year in fall. That student, if they were within engineering and within the Honors College, they would be paying an additional $755 on top of their base tuition, which is over 50% of their regular tuition. So overall, we need to make sure that we're not setting up our students for failure, that we're addressing these issues and setting ourselves up in a responsible system that accounts for it within financial aid, provides transparency for students, and really allows us as a system to nurture our students and provide success. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Walker, just before I walk away, I just want to respond to one thing that you said about the financial aid. They do take it into financial aid only after a student goes back into the financial aid office and asks for their financial aid package to be recalculated. So actually, a student has to go back in because they can't, otherwise, it's, you know, they don't know which major a student is when they give a student a financial aid package. So they have to go back in and get the package recalculated, and many students don't even know that that's an option.
Well, I did talk to Frances Dyke, and she indicated that when a student registers for a different program, the financial aid will office will review the package and recalculate it.
I believe it. Yes, yeah. I do believe that's true, as long as the student goes back and asks for that.
Well, you know, we've got Bart Lewis here, who's retired University of Oregon staff, and he's going to be able to tell us some things. So I'm going to have to speed this along. Thank you very much. I'm going to hear from, we have two more folks, Jay Kenton and Bart Lewis. You can sit at opposite sides here if you wish. And I'm very pleased that Bart was able to make it up, since he is retired and does many other things these days, but so many years. I know Mr. Lewis was there when my children were at the University of Oregon, and I had to call him a couple of times about some financial aid issues, but welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Shall I go first?
Yes, okay. I'd like you to, and then we'll have the university system finish.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, my name's Bart Lewis, and I recently retired from the Student Billing Department of the University of Oregon, and I'd worked in that department for 25 years. I was a member of the clerical staff, and I answered questions from parents and students. And in recent years, this volume of questions has been increasing because of these resource fees. We get phone calls, emails, in-person visits from both students and parents. I won't repeat what the students have told you, but from a staff point of view, my feeling right from the beginning was that these resource fees would become a public relations problem for us. They seem to many of our parents and students to be inherently unfair. Why would a chemistry student or math student have to pay more for their education than an English major or a history major? Not to mention the really large costs for programs like College of Business or the Honors College. Particularly, I always think of the chemistry or the math people. We're trying to get more people to teach in our K through 12 programs, and yet we're charging math majors more than another kind of liberal arts major. So there's the unfairness of it that people tell me about, and they've asked me to tell my supervisors, please do something about this. It doesn't seem right to them. The other aspect is that fees are hard for parents to get their hands around. They tend to think in terms of what is their child's tuition cost, what will room and board cost, how much for books and supplies. And most people think tuition pays your academic cost, but we at the Oregon University system don't really do it that way. We don't lump it all into one tuition cost where everybody pays the same amount. There are some fees that we add on, some everybody pays, the mandatory fees. They pay a matriculation fee of $250 at the U of O when they first register. But then they also have fees for certain classes that they take. A physical education class might have an extra $40 fee, called an activity fee. A chemistry class will have a chemistry lab fee and so forth. Or a theater class might have an extra film fee assessed. And now we've added these resource fees. And where do people find out about these? Because they're not lumped in with tuition. They're variable. They have to go to either the catalog or start surfing through our web pages to find the business office web page. And I really feel that it's kind of condescending to people when you have to tell them, oh, you should have read page 6 of this catalog, or why didn't you follow this link to get to somewhere else. I think the public would appreciate more combine costs, give them a total bottom line, and cut out these kinds of extra resource fees. And also, from my own personal level, to me, that's what public education is all about, and we're heading more in the direction of offering some programs that cost more and others that are cheaper, and not giving all kids a chance to pursue their own course of study on a fair basis.
Thank you. Mr. Lewis. I really appreciate that. I was sitting here thinking about when I was a student and I had to switch a class because the teacher had assigned so many books for the class that I couldn't afford all those books. And so I had to switch to another class that had one book. And, I mean, there weren't a lot of resource fees back in the 70s. This is sort of a newer phenomenon. But you're right. What does a student do if they've chosen a major and they've got suddenly they take a class and they find out they've got a $75 or $100 resource fee they didn't expect? So thank you for the perspective of being on the ground. So, Mr. Kenton, what say you?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jay Kenton. I'm the Vice Chancellor of Finance with the Oregon University System. And my job responsibilities, unfortunately, include the establishment and maintenance of tuition and fee policies for the system. So I wanted to talk to you about this. Let me begin by stating our students have made it clear, not unlike, you know, the commentary you've heard this morning, to our State Board of Higher Ed, that they feel resource fees are unfair, less than transparent, and essentially a form of tuition increases. The board has heard these concerns and has asked me to work with OSA and the various student government leadership around the system in an attempt to find a means to clarify and resolve these issues. As Ms. Unger noted, shortly after the introduction of this bill, Melissa and I met and agreed to form a committee, and in fact, we'll have our third meeting of that committee immediately following this hearing.
Good.
Some of the issues we agreed to address are better oversight over tuition and fee policies, a better process that would provide greater transparency and more student input, a better procedure regarding setting costs of attendance, and other financial aid budgets to account for these costs, and some quick wins in these areas. We'll be making a preliminary report to the Board of Higher Education regarding these fees at their May 2007 meeting, and I expect that the board will continue to engage in these policy discussions over the next several months. Let me just clarify some background, some facts about resource fees. First of all, students generally receive supplemental services as a result of paying resource fees. These include services such as greater access to technology on campus, enhanced student services such as placement, greater access to guest lecturers who are practitioners in their field, and so on. There's generally a relationship between resource fees and program cost. For example, higher cost programs typically have higher resource fees. That's why you'll see them in engineering and some of the science areas. And this will be one of the fundamental policy issues that the Board of Higher Education will deal with as it discusses tuition policy in the future. That gets back to the differential tuition question. Many resource fees were the direct result of students indicating that they wanted to obtain higher quality or expanded services and were willing to pay a fee for such services. In many cases, these fees were affirmed through surveys or referenda involving the student populations that would be directly impacted by these fees. Today, many resource fees are offset by fee remissions, especially for needy students, although, as noted by the student testimony, improvements could and should be made in this area. Finally, it is my understanding that all campuses do include some estimate of average resource fees in their cost of attendance calculations used for financial aid purposes. Those are average numbers, so some students will be overfunded by those budgets, other students will be underfunded. And as noted earlier in earlier testimony, students can go back to the financial aid and have those budgets adjusted subsequent to the fact, but that's typically at a point where the grant funding has expired. As you probably know, resource fees are currently limited by a legislative budget note to no more than 9.1% of tuition. We have assumed that this limitation will continue and have advised campuses to formulate their fee proposals for 07-09 based on this assumption. We regret the necessity of assessing these types of fees and do care very much about maintaining access and affordability for all students. Our board proposed the shared responsibility model and premised this 0709 legislative budget request on limiting tuition and fee increases to the projected change in median family income. Yet our board is also very concerned about maintaining quality academic programs and the financial sustainability of the system. Today, OUS is in a very precarious financial position, as demonstrated by the following indicators. Many of our expenditures are largely outside of our control and are growing more rapidly than our revenues. Revenues are insufficient to cover expenditures and are limited by budget note or insufficient tax revenues. Multiple campuses are close to the point of becoming financially unsustainable. Faculty salaries and compensation lag peers to the point that many searches either fail or have to settle for less than top candidates. Student-faculty ratios are well above the levels of our peer institutions. We have $640 million in deferred maintenance in our academic facilities. In 2005-07, the system will use 22% of its reserves to cover expenses not covered by available revenues, even after most campuses made budget reductions. So I ask, given these constraints and needs, how are we supposed to fund this enterprise? We share your concerns about fees, and we do want to maintain quality, retain and recruit a faculty, maintain our facilities, and keep tuition and fees low. But how do we do that under these conditions? Our students not only deserve a quality education, they will need one to be competitive in today's global economy. We need your help. Supporting the governor's recommended budget is a very positive first step. But it is only that, a first step. I pledge to you that we will work with OSA and you to address these issues in a positive and productive manner. However, I feel that we are already addressing the issues requested in this bill. Thus, I am not sure that there is much to gain by further limiting resource fees at this time. I'd be happy to answer any questions you
may have. Mr. Kenton, we don't have time for questions. And I appreciate your comments, but I actually disagree with your last comment that you're already addressing these. The students have clearly said that no one's listening, and that's why they're here. So I'm holding this bill until next Thursday. I'm bringing it back next Thursday. Because we got a little email from LFO thinking they want this bill down in Ways and Means. I disagree. It also gives you time to have another meeting with the students and figure out where you guys want to go. This is a real issue for them. I understand that resource fees are necessary for the university system to operate because we underfund it, but we've got a problem and we need it fixed.
I don't disagree with you.
All right.
You very much.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1029. Colleagues, we are going till 10:15. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 913. We've got a guest from Coos Bay on this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 913 directs the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to establish an alternative administrative license. Qualifies the holder of this administrative license to serve in any administrative assignment for which specified requirements have been completed. Allows issuance of a license to a qualified person who has completed courses in education law and school finance law and either has 15 years of full-time teaching experience or holds a graduate degree in business administration or public administration. In addition, we have a dash one amendment before. Shall I speak to that briefly?
Sure.
The dash one amendment is a bet and stuff of the substantive provisions of the bill. It directs the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to establish the alternative administrative license similar to the original bill. It allows issuance of the license to a qualified person who has completed courses in education law and school finance law. The person must also have 15 years of full-time teaching experience and hold a degree in graduate degree in business administration or public administration, as opposed to the bill, which is or. The dash one amendment also specifies the license renewal requirements.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Herbert, we've got 15 minutes to hear your two bills.
Okay.
So keep that in mind as you testify, and I'll keep the other folks brief.
Okay, we have written testimony there that you can read that will explain some of this. Now, you do have the Dash 1 Amendment where we increase...
Yeah, first you're going to have to state your name for the record. Even though I know who you are, other people don't.
Okay, yeah, my name is Bruce Herbert, and I live in Florence. The purpose of this bill, it came from some conversations that I had with a number of people looking at, you know, providing some alternative means of credentialing school administrators. There's kind of a crunch coming, and if you read the letter from Dr. Doug Morgan of Portland State, who's on the Portland School Board and teaches public administration at PSU, he notes that, as several other people have said, that there are it's getting more and more difficult to find school administrators. We have a lot of people retiring, and it's going to be tough to replace some of those people. The purpose of this bill, this isn't thinking way outside the box. This is kind of starting in the center of the box and maybe making a very small step off toward the side, looking at whether people with some different kinds of skills would be able to serve effectively as especially secondary school administrators, but also in elementary schools. It doesn't come from the idea that schools ought to be run more like businesses, or that, you know, if business people would just get a hold of them with their MBAs, that, you know, we'd have ruthless efficiency and everything would be fine with the schools. It's more looking at some people out there who have done things already, who have a background that's like much of the background that you find in a school administration program. And I know I've run across that years and years ago. I was thinking about actually going into school administration. And I sat down with one of the people from the program at the University of Oregon and said, here's what I have. I have an MBA. I have two doctoral minors in management and 300 hours of credits in business and economics and several decades of teaching experience and several other things. You know, if I come into your program, where do I stand? And his response was, at the same place that any third-year teacher who's just starting out, who's never got a course in school administration or has never taken a business course is. Yeah, you have to go through the entire program. You don't know any more than they do. And I thought at the time, and I thought over the years, as I keep thinking about that statement, you know, it sort of ignores reality that you know, people who come to have those kinds of credentials, if you've gone through an MBA program or an MPA program, you know, you've done a great deal of work in management, in accounting, and finance, and marketing, and human resources. You know, the work is fairly rigorous in those programs. It's often much more rigorous than the work that's in school administration programs, in fact. And it makes some sense, I think, to at least see if people who do this, who have substantial teaching experience and have, you know, credential. We're talking about requiring a course in finance, a course in school law, a course in curriculum at the level they're going to be working. For the renewal, they have to have courses in management and or administration of special ed, management and evaluation of personnel, human resources policy, advanced law, or state and local educational policy. So by the time they get through, we're talking about somebody who's got an MBA or MPA, where they've done a great deal of the same kind of work. They have half of the coursework that they would have in a normal school administration program and a substantial amount of teaching experience. So they both understand the educational enterprise and have the coursework background. Plus, I think the people who do that come at it from a slightly different angle. The extra background you get in those kinds of management courses, whether that's an MBA or an MPA, see things a little differently and understand some things about the way enterprises are managed. Management is not just going from teaching to administration, as Dr. Morgan says. It's an entirely different field and has its own skill set. And so we think that it makes a certain amount of sense. I mean, it's a fairly extreme set of credentials that somebody has to have in this case. On the third page of the staple handout you have, there is actually a way for people to become credentialed in this area right now. There's a special administrative license that districts apply for and the state can grant. There are a couple of problems with it. One is that the certification goes with the district and not with the individual. So if somebody's working for District A and does well and decides they don't want to work for District A anymore, and they leave, they no longer have a certification. So they have to go through and hope that another district can get that, or they have to go through the regular channel, which takes some years to do. And I think this approach, at least with regard to this one set of credentials, and it's only this one set, it doesn't change that policy, but with regard to this one set of credentials that people would have that we think are pretty sufficient, it sets them out in law, and it keeps us from having the kinds of arbitrary and capricious decisions where somebody would be okay in one district but not in another.
Okay. Well, let me call up the two people who've signed up to testify in opposition to your bill. I'll keep it brief, and then we'll bring you back for your second bill.
Okay.
Mr. Bennett and Ms. Chamberlain. I'll be very brief and submit written testimony so we can hear Mr. Herbert's other bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, the Executive Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Madam Chair, I didn't put opposition on the bill. I signed up opposed to the bill, and primarily based on the assumption that the teaching experience and the master's degree experience in management would be sufficient to be an instructional leader. And what I'd call your attention to, I did include the license. I include the statute that directs us to be accountable for flexible licenses for legislators. But I also attach the current standards for school administration. That's right immediately behind the testimony. And the single letters are the areas, visionary leadership, and instructional improvement. The bottom of my testimony, I think, are the two things I want to focus on quickly, in that the job of school administration isn't about management. It's about instructional leadership, and it's about leading low-performing schools, knowing about student development. I think it is a coincidence about the school violence yesterday, but teaching in a classroom doesn't arm you to do the things it takes to do inspired leadership, and No Child Left Behind is about inspired leadership and focusing on every child. And the research shows that buildings that are successful and districts that are successful are all led by qualified and inspired leadership. So I was encouraged to see some pointed type of renewal requirements on this, because my second point is that to evaluate licensed staff, you need more skills than having merely taught. And so, for example, I taught in PE. I wouldn't be qualified to evaluate my other colleagues that I taught within that building in all the areas. That it really does take some training, expertise, and experience. So I will hand it to Mr. Bennett, because I know you're in a hurry.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. We join Ms. Chamberlain in her opposition to the bill. Since 2003, Oregon's invested a great deal of time and energy reviewing and revising administrator licenses. We believe that the work product has been very good to guarantee the kind of educational leadership the state has come to expect in our local school districts. We also have a flexible system for meeting the needs of school districts that have decided they would like to have administrators with alternative licenses. A couple of good examples are Gretchen Schutte, who was superintendent of Gresham School District and then became president of Chemeketa Community College, and Jim Scherzinger, who left the revenue office and the finance job at Portland Public Schools, left the legislative revenue office and then the finance job at Portland Public Schools and became superintendent. They're both outstanding leaders in the state that met the needs of their districts at the time. We think there is substantial flexibility available in the existing system and would oppose any changes to it right now. Certainly these kinds of issues can be discussed by TSPC, but it is really the way we like to see these issues addressed is through TSPC.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? All right, thank you. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 913. Mr. Herbert, you've got 5 minutes. We'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 918.
and wait a minute for Ms. Richardson to talk to us about the bill, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 918 allows a small charter school that converted from a public school status and is located in a district with a less than 3,000 average weighted daily membership to qualify for additional remote small entry school, small elementary school, or small high school funding. It declares an emergency and will take effect July 1st, 2007.
Okay, you're our only guest to sign up today, so you have the last 5 minutes.
Do I need to identify myself?
Yes, do, yes, please.
Bruce Herbert of Florence Irving. This is sort of a technical fix in a way. Small schools get what's called a small school allocation, that schools are usually under 330 kids. I taught for over 20 years at Waldport High School on the coast in Lincoln County, and Waldport was most of the time in that category and got that. It makes a difference what you can do in terms of programs. Small charter schools were excluded from that, whether it was intentional or not, by the 1998 legislation, and authorized, or 99 legislation authorizing charter schools. It makes a huge difference in the same types of schools. Not too far from where I live, we have Mapleton High School, for example, which is a public school getting a small school allocation, has about 70 kids. They have 7.36 FTE teachers. So that makes a school, a class size of about a little less than 10. I was part of a group that was trying to start a charter school in Florence at one time, and with our budget, we were projecting somewhere around the same number of kids, maybe slightly more. With the amount of funding that we would have had, we were stretching to get to 2.5. Those extra people, when you talk about elementary school programs, it's not so bad. They're pretty scalable. That's why this bill doesn't address elementary schools. It also doesn't address regular or charter schools started by public school districts, because they have resources within them to allocate, you know, a seventh of a teacher here or 2/7 here or whatever the fractions are that they need. Charter schools can't do that in all the time. At least it's pretty hard to. So the whole idea here is to try to provide small charter schools in rural areas, and that's thing with districts that are under 3,000. That's, if you want to cut off for that, Ashland at the last time I looked was slightly over 3,000. Phoenix Talent was slightly under 3,000. I don't know what they've done the last couple of years, but that's about the size we're looking at in that break point. Schools who are organized as independent charter high schools, you know, with this extra money will have the funds to be able to hire some of the specialists they need in math and science. It's hard to find combinations of teachers. You might find a math science. You can probably find a language arts social studies. It's pretty hard to find some of the other combinations that you need to come up to the amount of money you have. And so this seems to make a certain amount of sense in terms of equalizing the opportunities available. It doesn't make small, rural, independently operated charter schools any easier to establish in the first place. School districts still have veto power, so the only ones that get through are the ones they want. Right now, there are only, I think, 5 small, rural charter high schools in Oregon. So I think 2 of those were established by Native American tribes. One of them is Eddyville High School, which operated as a functioning school, stopped for a couple of years after it was closed, and then reopened as a charter school. So same building. They already had their building. They had some of their materials and supplies and things from before. There are only 2 that fit into the category that, you know, would be, you know, people who have come out from the outside and started a charter school in a rural area. One's in Phoenix and one's in Lincoln City. So, you know, it's right now the financial impact is pretty small, but the educational impact will be pretty great.
Okay. Well, you did just perfect. It's 10:15. Any questions from the committee? Mr. Herbert, I want to thank you for coming over from Florence and sharing these bills with us today. And I want to thank you for teaching our kids for 20 years.
Oh, it was actually longer than that. I was there for 21.
Oh, great. Well, I went to Waldport High School for a tour one day, and they've got a hallway that sort of goes like this because of the flooding you've had there from time to time.
Yeah, I can tell you. I'll tell you not now, but later I'll tell you an interesting story about it.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, sir. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 918. Colleagues, we are going to just be running our tails off early, late, whatever, to get the work done. And remember that next Thursday we're going to have a night hearing from 6 to 8. So be prepared for that. And with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.